Good morning.
Good morning.
That was Heaven by Duke Ellington, composed in 1968 as part of his second sacred concerto. I'll talk more about that in the context of my discussion. Today, what I want to do is to talk about the link between jazz and spirituality. It may not come to mind to a lot of folks that the two are linked that closely. Matter of fact, it's a lot of folks, they may seem like oil and water. It may seem like they're kind of mutually contradictory, jazz and spirituality, jazz and religiosity. But so what I want to do today is talk a little bit about how the two have played out together, the two concepts have played out together in the history of jazz, and then talk a little bit about why I think that jazz and spirituality do have some things in common. And then I want to end the presentation with a little question and answer. I would like you folks to ask me some questions. I am a professor, not a minister, so I do want to take questions. No offense, Mr. Minister, but I do want a little Q&A at the end of this, and then we will conclude with some more music. But let me start with just a little bit of a historical overview. Make no mistake about it, in the early days of jazz, jazz was a very much of a down and dirty kind of music. It's the music of the bordello and the ball and the barroom. Good time music for dancing, drinking, and all kinds of nefarious activities. And the two, whenever a town had a vice district like Storyville in New Orleans or places like that, or the red light district in Kansas City in the 20s, the jazz and those nefarious activities went together hand in glove. However, we do have manifestations of spirituality in early jazz, and some of you, or many of you, may be familiar with the Jazz Funeral of New Orleans, and that is very much linked to the concept of spirituality in New Orleans jazz. And let me just quote a couple of New Orleans jazz musicians in regards to this. New Orleans jazz musician Dr. Michael White says, "People come to jazz funerals in New Orleans because it's part of the spiritual celebration. We celebrate and laugh at life. We celebrate and laugh at death. We dance at the occasion. We're happy because you're going to a better reward. We're sad because you're not here anymore. We're sad because we're going to miss you. We're happy because you're going to a better place permanently." And then Jelly Roll Morton, who is one of the great early jazz artists, says, "Rejoice at the death and cry at the birth. New Orleans sticks close to the scriptures." With the exception of this distinct exception to the manifestation of spirituality in jazz, mostly we're talking about music for entertainment. As early jazz moves into the swing era of the 1930s and 40s, essentially jazz is linked to dancing and good times and celebration and things like that. However, when we move into the modern jazz era of the 1950s, then some of the elements of black church music and black religious experience start to come into jazz. And within the black community, it's easy to imagine that jazz was always heralded as this wonderful thing. However, the old-timers will tell you that it was very, very controversial within the black community among the most religious-minded blacks early on, that it was a very sinful thing early on. As you move into the 1950s, though, some of the great artists of the era started getting little flavorings of religion in their music. And one of the little flavorings that started to crop up was gospel music. And there's a great album by Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers called Moanin'. And the Moanin' refers to speaking in tongues in the church. And I have some recorded examples, some short recorded examples to play for you. This is the song Moanin' from Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, recorded in 1957. And we're going to hear his little reference to Amen in there, and see if you can catch the musical reference to Amen. It's instrumental, but let me see if you can hear the Amen. Thank you. painful for me to have to turn that off, but we must move along. So in the modern jazz era, you start to get to references of the black jazz, the black religious experience. And you just heard one. Another would be some of the music of Charles Mingus. Charles Mingus loved to mix different parts of jazz, black history into his music. He loved Duke Ellington. He loved his own religious family religious experience was Pentecostalism, and some of his music he you can hear him shouting in the background like a noisy tent revival is going on. And I have another excerpt to play for you. This one is Charles Mingus, Better Get It in Your Soul. So you can hear Charles yelling in the background. Himself shouting in the background, and no, he was not firing a band member at them, although he often did that on the bandstand. As we move out into the 1960s, all of society was changing along with the arts. There are folks here that remember the 60s? Yeah, so the same kind of ferment and change that was affecting all of the arts and all of society was affecting jazz as well. And jazz musicians' individual religious experiences were manifesting themselves in very overt ways now. The piece that we started with, Heaven by Duke Ellington, is a perfect example of that. Duke Ellington, perhaps the greatest jazz composer who ever lived, who was composing jazz tunes since the 1920s, also a lifelong devout Catholic. And it was in the 1960s that some of his extended works explicitly referenced that, and he composed whole sacred concerts. And also you have other musicians as well. Mary Lou Williams, who was a wonderful swing-era pianist, composer, composed an entire jazz setting of the Mass. And then as you move into other references to religion, in particular comes to mind John Coltrane. Coltrane himself was raised Christian, but began questioning and exploring different religious traditions, Eastern religion, Islam. And he attributes his religious feelings and his relationship with God to saving his life. His very serious addiction to heroin that he was able to himself clean up cold turkey, fasting, and praying. And he really thanks God for saving his life. And in the year 1964, he composed an album of music called A Love Supreme. And he is... There's a repeated theme in the song where you will hear the theme come up again and again. A love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme. I'm going to play a short excerpt for you, and you'll hear that theme in the music. And before we play that, let me just read you his liner notes referring to this album. During the year 1957, I experienced, by the grace of God, a spiritual awakening which was to lead me to a richer, fuller, more productive life. At that time, in gratitude, I humbly asked to be given the means and privilege to make others happy through music. I feel this has been granted through His grace. Very painful for me to have to turn that off, but we have to move on. As we move into the 60s and 70s, all kinds of manifestations of spirituality, religiosity play out in the jazz idiom. John McLaughlin in Eastern Religion with the Mahavishnu Orchestra in the 1970s. Wynton Marsalis in the 1990s with his album In the House on This Morning, a direct reference to the gospel-tinged hard bop of the 1950s that we heard a little bit earlier. John Zorn, referring to the spiritual roots of Judaism in the avant-garde, it mixes avant-garde music and klezmer music and so forth. Different of the great jazz musicians were themselves devoutly religious in different ways. Harold Land and Herbie Hancock were Buddhists. Dizzy Gillespie embraced the Baha'i faith. Art Blakey, Billy Higgins, Ahmad Jamal were Muslims. Chick Corea was Scientologist. So very diverse set of religious backgrounds. I don't know of any big name jazzers who were Unitarians per se, but I'll keep doing my research and get back to you if I find anything. So there's a little historical background. But the question remains, why do I think that jazz is spiritual? I think jazz is spiritual because I think of spirituality is a search for truth, whatever one's religious beliefs and whatever one's organized religion or personal religion is. And jazz really exposes insincerity. It's a very demanding form. I mean, some of you may know that jazz has a very complex musical structure. Improvisation is central to it, but that improvisation adheres to a very strict set of chord changes, and in extremely demanding to do it well and to do it in a way that's faithful. And it may not be expressed in religious terms necessarily, but insincerity is exposed ruthlessly on the bandstand. If you have not done your homework, if you are not totally committed to the demands of the improvisation and to putting your whole self into the music, you will be exposed. You will fall short. So the sincerity of effort is so important in jazz. It also transports one to an altered state of consciousness. It is very, it puts you in your own world. Musicians do communicate in their own way, in their own language. And the communication that takes place on the bandstand between the different musicians in a small group jazz setting is really remarkable. It's almost telepathic. So it is, in a sense, an altered state of consciousness that with its own ethic of search for truth. It rewards the striving for truth without necessarily providing any answers. And I think that's a philosophy that may appeal to some of us in this room. And it's also, among the greatest jazz musicians, there was always the sense that you never quite know it all, that you never quite arrive at the ultimate set of answers, that throughout your life you are searching and you're trying to grow. John Coltrane, I must say, especially is a great example of that. Never thought that he knew it all. Always trying to grow, always trying to reach. And especially in his late music, it was growing very hard for folks to understand it. So in some ways, it was cacophonous to a lot of folks. But it was driven by his need to express himself and this idea that he is reaching and searching for answers from somewhere, wherever it might lead him. So that's my case for why I think that jazz and spirituality are linked together. And at this time, I would really invite you some of your thoughts and your questions that you may have. Yes, yes, and jazz musicians, especially in their learning stages, will do a lot of what you're referring to as transcriptions, transcribed solos. Learning transcribed solos essentially is learning somebody else's language that you want to imitate. And imitation is an important part of learning to play jazz, but it's only a means to an end. It's you're trying to get to the point where you can express yourself in your own language, but in the road to going there, you may need to imitate others in order to learn the language and learn the idiomatic language of jazz. So that's a very important step in the process, but the ultimate goal is self-expression through music. Other questions? Sure. I teach at a small school, University of Wisconsin Superior. We have an enrollment of about 2,800 students. And I teach basically everything connected with the jazz curriculum there. Jazz history, I direct the combo, the big band. There's one big band, large jazz band, and then usually several smaller groups, jazz combos. I also teach jazz improvisation there. Jazz composing and arranging, and I teach a course called jazz pedagogy, which trains music educators to go out and teach jazz in the schools. So we have a little bit of we offer a little bit of everything, but it's sort of a one-man show there because we are a small school. I don't have the luxury of having multiple faculty devoted to the subject, although I sometimes dearly wish that was the case. Yes.
When your wife sang that song, now I've heard that instrumentally, but I haven't ever heard it sung. And it gave me the sensation, a nail being scratched across the blackboard, because I was so unused to the subtlety of these minor notes. I think she's extremely
thank you. Yes.
Does other countries or cultures have jazz?
Yes, especially beginning in the 1930s, the jazz started to spread internationally. Although it was born in America, it certainly is a worldwide phenomenon now. And I've been to many conferences for the International Association of Jazz Education, and there you will hear jazz from Scandinavia, from China, from all over the place. It's really a worldwide phenomenon. Yes.
I'm
I think it's a very good point. It's a very good point. I think, and I think it dovetails with the point I was making about an altered state of consciousness, where you do, and I've experienced that many times myself. So it's a very good point. Yes. Well, that's you know, bless you for that endorsement. I wish we had folks like you that were packing the jazz clubs instead of the ones that want to drink and talk to each other. it's uniquely personal expression. It's spontaneous. Since improvisation is spontaneous creation of music, it occurs in the moment, and when it's done well, it never happens that way again. When you're hearing live jazz, you're hearing something that is not going to be heard again. And it's the goal of the musician to not be repeating themselves, because that would be untruthful, to be constantly playing the same solo over and over again. So maybe you as an audience listener are picking up on some of that, I don't know. Everybody has their own reaction, I think, but it's I would say it's unique in that it's such a personal statement of the musician, and it is so spontaneous, and you will not hear that exactly the same way ever again. Okay, if there are no other questions, I would like to say a few closing words that before we conclude with our final piece. And this refers to the emotional power of African music. And these are the words of a gentleman who went and studied West African drumming. And I find it relevant because it refers to this altered state of consciousness and the sense of community that comes with becoming a part of the music. He says, the emotional power of drumming is such that I, a musician not from an African culture, experienced a personal transformation while living and drumming with the Ewe, Ga, and Akan people in Ghana. One day I played the Kagan drum all afternoon, and I became conscious then of something I did not understand intellectually, but knew intuitively in my heart. The people's way of life in drumming made sense, and I felt as if I had come home. Once in the village of Entenema, I had played the Tikiti drum for hours, putting my whole self into Gahu ensemble music. A woman wiped my forehead with a cloth, a traditional way of showing appreciation. Her simple act stays with me to this day, even when I am playing the drum set. At an all-night funeral near Accra, where I played the Kankakui double bell, I felt connected to myself, the music, and all the people in a way that does not often occur in our society. I was not alienated, alone, afraid, wondering if I was worth anything. Instead, I was able to believe in my own value and in my ability to love and connect with others, nature, and with the Creator. I'd like to conclude with a piece of music. My wife Tanya and I will perform. This is Corcovado, which is a piece of Brazilian music mixed with American jazz. And it refers to the statue of Christ the Redeemer that, with the outstretched arms overlooking Rio de Janeiro. This is Corcovado by Antonio Carlos Jobim.
Chama, eu quero. você eu conheci. O que felicidade, meu Gracias.